Joining us in a studio, Jake Shepherd, his founder and director at Synthesis. And we're going to continue our conversation that we started before, which is establishing workplace culture. This morning, we're going to look at it in a little bit more detail, Jake, and try and understand exactly how we determine what that culture should be.
Sure.
And how we go about doing it.
Thank you for having me on again. It's a real pleasure.
Well, we keep having you back, so it clearly must be working.
Yeah, and I think what I want to actually just talk about a bit more today is the notion of deliberate culture, needing to actually understand what it is you're trying to achieve with your culture, and also recognizing the fact that you can't just expect your culture to remain unaffected and over time, and you actually have to actively shape that culture and actually give it direction. Another way of thinking about it is you can't just let the culture of your company be a miniature reflection of the country's culture at large. Mm. Specifically, if you're trying to shape something that is different to what the country's culture is.
Which is so pertinent to South Africa, where we've got a tremendous amount of negativity in the real world. But in fact, you want to create a culture that is positive, upbeat, and forward-thinking.
That's 100% correct. And we talked about Elon Musk's letter of communication to staff, where he basically he warned managers about creating silos where people, us versus them. And he said this is like a natural tendency, and it needs to be actively fought against. And I think what we need to realize is unless we know exactly what it is we're trying to protect or what we're trying to create, we don't know what we're trying to fight for.
So how do we start? I mean, how do we decide, you know, every company I would imagine has a culture that's developed maybe passively or maybe be from the personalities of the founders, owners, directors.
So spot on. And I think sometimes you need to get lucky with that starting point. And I think what would be quite interesting is just a personal anecdote of my own.
Right.
I grew up in Brakpan and I went to Brenthurst Primary School.
Ooh.
Very much a government primary school.
Okay.
And you can imagine discipline was the thing. Straight lines outside of classrooms.
Right.
You walk into a classroom, it's dead quiet. You know, the teacher's walking in, total respect for the teacher. You never chat back or speak, challenge the teacher in any way. And I distinctly remember waiting outside of the science class for it to start, and the science master, realizing I was out of line, and gave me a choice. He said, you can have the green or the black mamba, which is his stick to instill a little bit of discipline.
Actually, it breaks my heart to hear this type of story. But that's how we grew up.
But when I actually think back about this, I was actually quite happy. There was order to my world. And I knew where I fitted in. And that was actually quite okay.
I think they call it Stockholm Syndrome.
It could well be. And this happy period of my life came to an end when my mother convinced my father to send me to Hillel, a Jewish day school in Benoni. And what followed was probably the six most traumatic months of my life. matric included, okay? Mm. And the reason is the classrooms were mayhem. I don't think they'd heard of a line. I think the whole concept of a uniform was and dress code was a suggestion.
Right.
Okay.
It was a guideline.
It was a guideline, maybe at best. Mm. And I found that incredibly traumatic and very difficult to adjust to. And I think one way of so over time, I've actually tried to understand why that is. And I really suffered from what I'd call culture shock.
Mm.
I was coming into this totally different culture. And it really was difficult for me to acclimatize. And in 2009, there was an interesting book that was written called Israel Startup Nation.
Yes.
By Dan Senor and Saul Singer. And basically what they were talking about was they were trying to work out what were those things that made Israel a startup nation and a business success. And they touched on facets like immigration, Russian immigration, and mandatory military service. But they also touched on cultural things. In Israel, you have the concept of chutzpah, cheek, almost a little tinged with arrogance. You have the concept of bitzua, like just getting things done, or rosh gadol, basically literally meaning big head. But really, it's about taking ownership and responsibly and getting things done, doing things without recourse to formal authority. And really, I think maybe one way of trying to understand that sort of culture is through a humorous anecdote between Golda Meir and Richard Nixon. Golda Meir turned to Richard Nixon and said, "You are the president of 150 million Americans, and I'm the prime minister of 6 million prime ministers." and it just gives you that sense of total.
I think that Lyndon and I possibly could relate to that with our listeners. I'm just saying. Yeah.
And I think what the Israel Startup Nation, the reason the book, I mean, it made a lot of points and a lot of, there were great anecdotes and a lot of, things were said that sort of made sense, but I didn't feel that the dots were joined with a line. I always got a sense, well, you know, if Russian immigrants were the root of the success, well, then when they were in Russia, why isn't Russia a startup nation?
Yeah.
And if mandatory military service is the root of success, well, then why don't all countries that have armies produce these startup people that come out of the army? And actually, I think the army does exactly the opposite. It really, it's an authoritative structure and it squashes out any independence.
It's your primary school in Brakpan.
It's primary school in Brakpan. So I think really their cultural aspects were far more insightful in that book. And really all I want to do is just try and unpack that a little bit.
Because what's interesting, exactly that you're saying about Startup Nation, is it's the same people that came from a different place, were transplanted or lived in a different country, but absorbed a different type of culture, and that seems to have made all the difference.
Unlocked all that potential.
So how do you determine, how does that evolve? How do we become deliberate around culture and not haphazard?
So, I want to actually look, I always go off and get a bit theoretical and get a bit, look at the literature. Mm-hmm. For me, the light bulb moment was when I came across the work of Geert Hofstadter, who's a Dutch social psychologist who did a huge amount of work on power distance.
Right.
And in the 1970s, I think is when he started his research, he did a lot of work on IBM, which is like the first global multinational, and he looked at the cultures of different IBM offices around the world to try and determine to what extent the country's culture impacts on the IBM different satellite offices. And his main area of focus at that time was power distance. He subsequently done a lot more research in six different dimensions that define culture, but I think his most profound and the one that's most well known is power distance. And if you actually look at his research, what he found is that, well, first of all, how do you define power distance? And power distance is really the extent to which those people in an organization, an institution, or country who don't have power, to what extent they're happy with the power disparity or prepared to accept that power disparity. So really, he points out that power distance, which is, let's say, a deference to authority, another way of looking at it, is actually determined by the people with the least power. In other words, how much do they accept upon themselves somebody else's power who's over actually them. Over them? And a culture that doesn't accept it is a culture that has a low power distance, and a culture that does accept it.
How does it translate into something practical
So what he does actually some, I'm going to get to that, but what he does is he actually puts a number to it, and he has a scale between 0 and 100, where I suppose 0, a very low power distance, total anarchy. There's like no structure, no hierarchy, which we don't ever have a country like that or a company like that. You need, there's benefits
in some
sort of order.
Of hierarchy,
And then 100 is a whole bunch of mindless automons that can't think for themselves and just listen to all the commands. And we don't have that either. So really there's a continuum in the power distance between 0 and 100. And he looks at countries that have very high power distance. For example, Russia, which is at about 92, China, which is about 80.
I was
going to
say, I'm sure China, South Korea.
77 is for India. India's got 70. And a lot of the Arab countries have a very high power distance. And then he contrasts it with those countries that have a much lower power distance. So America has a power distance of about 39. Australia, about 34. New Zealand, interestingly enough, is very low at 22.
That's interesting.
And Denmark, incredibly low at 18. But the most outlier of all of them is Israel, with a power distance of 13. And just for the listeners who are interested, South Africa is somewhere in the middle. We have a power distance of 49.
Right.
So we fall in.
And I would imagine in South Africa also there's political and racial history that might have impacted on that as well. But
if you're looking at Russia and China, that's sort of communist era countries, you need high power distance because everything's central control.
Yeah.
It's all coming down from the Politburo. The central decision making. Unless those people are going to listen to us, and we're going to drum it into them that they have to. You can't actually maintain that sort of a philosophy.
Going back to Israel and linking that perhaps is which is, I'm assuming where you're going to a startup nation.
Yeah.
Why it's successful is perhaps because you don't have this massive disparity of power.
Exactly. Well, it's not that you don't have the massive disparity of power, that people reject that disparity of power.
Right. I'd love your thoughts on it. 34519 or 061-895-1019. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm chatting to Jake Shepherd, and we're talking about creating a deliberate culture. A very, very interesting example that he's just and in fact a metric that you've just provided as to how the distance of power can be measured and perhaps a success that relates to what the company is able to achieve around that. We'd love your thoughts. 34519 or 061-895-1019. It is 844. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem, 101.9. Chai FM. Joining me in studio is Jake Shepherd, founder and director at Synthesis. We're talking about creating a deliberate workplace culture.
Yeah, and I think one of the from the power distance research, what we've looked at is, and what Gert Hofstadt and others have actually shown, is that it actually has the difference between low power distance setting and a high power distance setting is dramatic, and it plays out across a whole bunch of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you're thinking about organizational structure, a high power distance, it's very centralized, hierarchical, command and control type of organizational structure versus a very flat organizational structure. It's almost the centralized versus the decentralized models.
Right. And doesn't it depend on what type of environment you're trying to create? In other words, if it is for example, an army, you want and in fact need a greater distance. But if you're trying to create...
I would say yes and no.
Okay.
I would say yes and no, because you're right, in an army, you need that central command structure to make your big strategic decisions. But if you rely on it too much, it actually weakens the very structure of your army, because unless there's autonomy at the different levels where people can independent decision making is supported, you don't have a flexible army. You have an incredibly inflexible army, and it can't react to situations on the ground as they unfold, because you're constantly having to find out from superiors across a broken communication link what to do.
Let's make this practical. We are, you know, someone's got a company, it's got really got a culture, it is what it is right now, or you're starting up a company. What are the steps then one has to take in order to determine what that culture is that you're trying to create?
So I think the first step is just to work out what it is the company's trying to do, and start there. Because, for example, I can really speak to my company in terms of what we're trying to do. So we're trying to embrace emerging technology and uplift our clients and make sure that they actually, take advantage of some of the new technology that's coming along. So in that environment, we need to prioritize innovation, and innovation becomes incredibly important. So let's apply low and high power distance to innovation.
So the greater the power distance, the less innovation you're going
to
have.
And the reason is because
people follow orders.
Or the ideas, the only ideas that work are those that are sanctioned from the top, which basically means you are missing out on all of those people within your organization that can contribute in a massive way. So all the great ideas coming across your organization from every area of the organization are squashed. They're not given the opportunity to flourish and to be heard and to be acknowledged on their merit, because the person who's saying it isn't given any sort of voice and voice authority. The other thing, I think if you look at like merit, the role that merit plays in an organization, in a high power distance setting or an environment, merit isn't that important. For example, maybe it's nepotism, or it's my friend gets the leadership position. Whereas in low power distance organizations, the only reason you're maybe in a superior position to your colleague is because you merit to be in that position, and you have to actively always show that merit. I think another area is ambiguity. How comfortable are people in the organization with ambiguity? Mm-hmm. Because in a high power distance environment, the top needs to clearly articulate their strategy, and everyone knows what's happening, and everyone's incredibly uncomfortable as soon as things become ambiguous.
Yeah, because they're waiting for instructions. They're
waiting
They've been
for
trained
instructions.
To wait for instructions.
So if you're trying to create a company that actually, where you don't, where you need the flexibility, you need people on the ground to be reactive to situations as they unfold, and you therefore need to make people a little bit more comfortable with ambiguous situations, you need to strive for a low power distance culture as opposed to a high power distance culture. So it's all tying in to what it is you're trying to create, and what sort of a company you're trying to create.
Linda, I'm interested in your thoughts around this.
No,
I can
see you're very drawn into
this conversation.
And I'm actually quite visualizing, because you're right. It's important for the company to know what it is that it's trying to do with the company. That way, because I'm thinking, if there is for some reason some development or whatever, depending on the culture and the power distance that you have there, you can literally remain the same and die out, because you've either got a huge power distance, and people can't voice out what it is, what changes are, what development is, because they're waiting for you to decide when the right time is, or if
passive,
it is.
And you're 100% right, because if you actually look at companies today, their challenge is how to change and adapt to an evolving world. And the more you moribund and you actually are in a fixed way, the less ability you have to actually react and change accordingly to the challenges that present themselves. So a high power distance company can't react and can't change.
Well, Ian makes a good point. He says, Jake, what tools do we use to ensure that everybody's voice is heard and, more importantly, responded to by a manager? It's one thing to say that everybody's view is important. It is another thing to show that these have seriously been considered by management and why perhaps they're not being implemented.
So I don't know if it's a tool so much. I don't think you use an online app.
Well, then there's no point if we can't download it.
It's very much an attitude. It's very much you cannot pull rank. Pulling rank is the concept where you use your position of authority to get your way. So as a manager, that tool, pulling rank tool, is actually off the table.
Right.
What you now have to do is any idea has
you
to be on its merits.
You
have to be able to convince people that, yes, I might, so to speak, be your superior, but the only reason you're listening to my idea is because the merit of my idea.
So,
but nothing to do with who I am.
And I'll add that further. I'll add something further. Is very quickly, people realize when words are only words. When we phone City Power and they tell us that our call is important to them, we don't believe them because their actions are not consistent with what they're telling us. So you can start off by saying everybody's voice is important and we want to hear, but unless that is seen in a authentic way, then that is never going to be successful. Rafe says, I didn't even know there were schools in Brakpan. Is that a recent thing? Time is 8:52. I'm Howard Feldman. This is Your Morning Mayhem, 101.9. Chai. Time is 8:55. I'm Howard Feldman. This is Your Morning Mayhem, 101.9. Chai FM. That's Dudu Aharon with Terminal 3. Joining me in the studio, Jake Shepherd, founder and director at Synthesis. And we're talking about creating a deliberate work culture. Jake, thank you for joining us. We've got 4 minutes left. How do we put this all together?
Thanks. Really, the culture, to really summarize, the culture of a company actually needs to serve the purpose of a company. Mm. So to a large extent, one needs to really understand what your company is about, your why of your company, which we've spoken about before. And in our case, our why of our company really is about technology innovation and embracing emerging technologies. And what that means is that we have to embrace everyone. We can't basically say innovation can only come from the top. We have a tremendous pool of talented individuals, and all of them are involved in innovation, every single one last person. And we have to create an environment that allows those ideas to come to the surface and come to the fore.
And I just want to make a point. It's not about innovation, because every company, no matter what you are, no matter if you're an engineering firm or a wholesaler or a retailer, it's allowing creativity and innovation within that space.
100%. And I've actually spoken to friends of mine who've come from a low power distance culture where their ideas were heard, and all of a sudden they had a company buyout, and it was a high power distance culture that they went into, and they've incredibly demotivated, and all of their good ideas are for naught. So I think, where do you think, if we allow things like corporate politics or other ways where we condone high power distance sort of activities, I think we can destroy the very culture that we need that causes our success. But I also want to just explain, maybe just sensitize people to the culture shock. When you start trying to shape a company culture that is different to the prevailing country culture, and new people are coming into your company, they are going to experience what I experienced when I went from Brenthurst Primary in Brakpan to Hillel in Benoni, a tremendous culture shock. You're going to feel totally out of your depth. You're going to feel totally, maybe not out of your depth the wrong way, but uncomfortable. And basically, where's my solid footing? I don't know what my role is. There's too much ambiguity. Who's my boss? Who's my direct report? And effectively, that's very unsettling. And I think we just need to embrace people coming in, know and tell them, listen, it is hard. This is a difficult transition that you're going through. We understand it. But really, let's look at the advantage that we gain through it. And it's worth persevering and really bringing in that culture and embracing that culture. And that's what you want to try and just do, is just be sensitive to the difficult time that new employees are going to go through. Because they're bringing in the external
And to some extent, it's a transitioning from, it's almost like a child to adult situation. And if you take a child who's had everything organized and managed for them, and you put them into a situation where all of a sudden they're not going to be told exactly what to do, where to do it, and how
spot on.
It can be very, very overwhelming.
It's becoming that adult, and it's becoming that having that equal power relationship between all of your colleagues. And that is often very unsettling. But just to explain to people, we acknowledge it, we understand it, and you're here for the journey, and we value you.
Ian says, for a future topic, please could you ask Jake to share with us how his team works with companies to embrace new technologies and to see it as a benefit and not as a threat. And he's also suggesting a book title for you, From Brenthurst to Hillel, A Cultural Journey. It is almost 9 o'clock, Jake Shepherd. Thank you, as always. Really, really fascinating.